The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'll try to say a few more words about the topic I mentioned this morning. A little bit louder. So let's see, is that loud enough now? So I think it's relatively common in many walks of life to distinguish between pleasure and happiness. And when they make this distinction, the distinction is between physical pleasure, which a person can experience while they're feeling quite unhappy. And then the corollary is you can feel physical pain while you're quite happy. That a pleasure or pain can be self-inflicted, inflicted by things around us. And to some degree, we have choice about that. And some people exercise that choice a lot around pleasure. In fact, many people are much more driven by the desire for comfort and pleasure than they'd probably care to admit. It's quite a common concern. And people organize their whole life, and sometimes, you know, their work and their earning money, and, you know, a lot of time is spent to earn enough money for some people so that they can have more pleasure. And they say, no, not me. But then they buy a car, which is more than they really need to get around, because they want to have a pleasant drive. They have a house that's bigger, or a view that's better, or clothes which are nicer, because it feels so good to have those clothes on. And that really soft cotton, the velvety cotton, you know, that costs twice as much as just going down to Target. And, I once went, many years ago I was buying a car, and so the car salesperson was taking me, I was taking, I guess, the person for a drive. And this was maybe 25 years ago or so. And the person said, it also comes with the air conditioner. And I said, well, I don't need air conditioner. And the person said, oh, well, you deserve it. You know, what does this person know about what I deserve? And that was the language, you know, it's... And so I could have gotten an air conditioner and paid some extra money, but the desire for comfort, for pleasure, drives people. Some people confuse happiness and pleasure, and so, for example, people who will pursue alcohol, food, sex, recreational opportunities. There's all kinds of things you can pay for and get and do, which are pleasant and give kind of a high, and if they're intensely pleasant, can really get you going, and, you know, for the time being, you feel really alive and engaged, and it's really great. But it's really induced by the experience that we're having. You can't, in the same way, induce happiness. You know, you can't just, like, you know, pay, you know, go down and pay a certain amount of money and, you know, the happiness store, and put down your $10 and, you know, and get a dose of happiness, and then, you know, that lasts for a week or so. But happiness is a little bit more ephemeral, and is not just dependent on the pleasure that we're experiencing. And so some people confuse that, so they're constantly in the pursuit of pleasure, and they need to keep that pleasure, and some people will do that to keep unhappiness at bay, because as long as they have the pleasure, they don't have to pay attention to anything else that's going on. So this distinction between pleasure and happiness, there's also a distinction between pain and unhappiness. And the happiness and unhappiness belongs to something internal, an inner sense of well-being, or the opposite of well-being, poor, I don't know, well-being and ill-being. A sense of well-being that is there for a lot of different factors, that are more than just what's physical. So the Buddha makes this distinction as well, but he makes it maybe differently than how we'd make it in the modern world. He makes a distinction between the feelings that are of the flesh, and the word that he uses, of the flesh, and those which are not of the flesh. Some people who translate this into English, they don't translate it as flesh. Sometimes they translate it as feelings which are worldly and feelings which are non-worldly or unworldly. And that seems a little odd to me to use that, but still that's one attempt to kind of translate this at least Pali terms. And the Buddha makes this distinction. And the place where he makes this distinction in his instructions of mindfulness is quite significant. And it took me a while to understand how important this transition is to see this distinction. But of the flesh has to do with those feelings we have that come from how our senses are stimulated. So if I see something, the eye sense is stimulated. If I hear something, taste something, smell something, or have tactile touch. And there's all the sense data that comes in. And that sense data can either be pleasant and unpleasant. The direct sense experience itself is pleasant and unpleasant in the moment that it's happening. It might remain unpleasant as a memory, but, you know, if I poke myself hard enough in my knee, it'll be painful. Take my hand away, my finger away, and it's no longer painful. It has to do with the stimulus operating. And of the flesh also includes in the, you know, it's, you have to kind of be a little bit expansive or permissive in your use of words in English. But the Buddhism has six senses. And there's a five ordinary senses that we refer to. And then there's a sense organ that allows you to recognize what's happening in your mind, kind of your inner life. And of your mind is, you know, so if you have a thought, you know you have a thought, because you can say, tell your friend, oh, I have a thought. And they say, really? And so then they'll hear your thought, you know, I was thinking about something. And, oh, you know, so you kind of recognize that you're having a thought. And that recognition happens through the mind sense. And that also is a momentary experience. When you're having a thought, there's a recognition of that thought. After that, it's just a memory of having the thought. And a thought can be pleasant and unpleasant. I've had unpleasant thoughts, and I've had pleasant thoughts. Some people, me as well, will get involved in our thoughts during meditation because of the pleasure it gives. Fantasies, wonderful fantasies, that all of a wide range of, and it just, the hook that keeps us going is the pleasure of it. And so there's the pleasant ones, and there's also the unpleasant ones. And oddly enough, the hook that keeps us going and going is the unpleasantness of those, that somehow they grab us, or we, you know, we're caught in its orbit somehow. And so there's a variety of things besides thoughts you can be aware of internally, but in the moment-to-moment experience of it, it's just sense data that comes in, and it can be pleasant, unpleasant, different ways that can be felt. Not of the flesh are feelings we have internally, which are not dependent on the senses being stimulated. So it depends more on how our inner biological, psychological systems are flowing, are working in harmony, or not working in harmony. It has to do with a sense, a feeling of what's actually going on. It's a little bit more like a mood, but sometimes it can be more enduring than a mood. But it's kind of like the inner quality of being that we have. And the sense of the inner quality of our being as being something that's worth paying attention to, I think is quite useful, because that's really much closer to where we're going to find our freedom, we're going to find our well-being and our happiness. It's where we find things like love and compassion, is residing in that place where we have an inner sense of our well-being, the quality of our being, quality of our inner life. And the quality of our inner life can be quite different than the quality of our outer life. A person can live in a very unpleasant environment, difficult environment, and it can be quite challenging externally, but internally there's a deep sense of well-being, deep sense of safety, deep sense of security, deep sense of confidence, able to kind of just, you know, that just holds a person, and the person can walk through the world, and the unpleasant experiences of the world don't penetrate very deeply. And in fact, if the inner sense of well-being is quite strong, it becomes almost like a shield, or like a, I don't know what the best analogy is, but it's almost like Teflon, maybe. You know, things happen, but it just doesn't stick. It just kind of keeps going off, ripping off, because it doesn't go anywhere. Or to a little bit borrow an analogy from the Buddha. The Buddha used the language of wetness and water often for some of these deep inner sense of well-being when it's really strong, this pleasures or feelings not of the flesh. And he talked about getting saturated with this fluid of joy and well-being. And so if you're really kind of filled and wet, the rain doesn't penetrate anymore. It doesn't have nowhere to go. You know, and so, you know, nothing can get in there because it's so full. The analogy the Buddha used a little bit for this kind of fullness of this inner sense of well-being that's well-established is if you take a wet ball of clay and you throw it against the solid door, the clay just kind of gets all flat and falls apart and just loses its shape. But if you take a ball of thread or yarn and throw it against the door, nothing happens to the yarn. Nothing kind of changes. And so somehow when we become resilient, we get not affected by things. When we're kind of in a certain kind of way, when we're soft but full, when we're a sense of happiness, well-being, joy, that kind of wells up from the inside. And so what kind of well-being is not dependent on the things in the environment, our senses, our experience, being pleasant and having good experiences? So there's probably probably many answers for this, but one of the answers, the primary one the Buddha gave, was through meditation practice. That when you meditate, that, nowadays we say, for example, serotonin starts flowing, or oxytocin starts flowing. And we have these kind of, maybe a little bit unfortunistic, you know, mechanical kind of descriptions of some of this well-being that begins welling up. But there's all these good feelings that begin flowing through our body. And sometimes you can feel it almost like a flow, like an energy is kind of vibrating or flowing throughout the body. And so maybe there are some chemicals that are being released as we do this practice. I like to think of it more that the language of the ancient texts is that of being unified, being collected. And the idea of unification means that we're not divided against ourselves. There's no conflict, or we're not going off in diverse ways. We're not dispersed with our energies and who we are. And so everything is kind of operating in harmony. Everything's operating together. And we're settled. There's not the stress levels. There's not preoccupations with other things and conflicts with this and that. And we're kind of settled, and we start becoming harmonized or unified, our psychophysical kind of functioning. And for our energies and our functioning to operate freely and flow nicely, and there seems to be, you know, just especially if it can just do one thing, just do this one thing, focus on the breath and get concentrated. There's some kind of inner stability, calm, settledness, undistractability. We're certainly not adding stressful factors into the mix. If your mind gets quiet and calm, you're not thinking about, you know, work stress and work jobs or relationship problems. You're not thinking about what you need in the future or what happened in the past. You're not having those kinds of thoughts, which are unpleasant, and that tend to then have a lingering effect, leave traces of us, where we start feeling kind of feeling bad because of the kind of thoughts we're having. And so we settle down, and we're not, and this natural functioning seems to operate more and more fully. The language the Buddha used for this, or the image he used for the analogy, was a lake, that a nice, beautiful, clear mountain lake, perhaps. And there, he says there was no rivers were flowing into the lake, and it's not raining. However, the lake is being replenished, and it's being replenished from the inside of the lake itself. So nothing's coming from the outside. There's no sense data coming in, no sights and sounds and all that. Nothing's required from the outside. And not raining, I don't know what that's the rivers. And the rain, I don't know what that is. Maybe that's the mind. And that doesn't rain down our thoughts or something. But rather, this lake has an underwater spring that wells up from the floor of the lake. And this nice flow of current coming up and replenishes the lake with refreshing water. And so the same thing we sometimes feel, some people feel it almost that way, sometimes it's other ways, but you sit and it gets settled, and this really nice feeling wells up. Some people will complain and say, well, that's, you know, where else can it be but in the senses? My senses are operating, it's my body, it's flowing here, so it must be of the flesh also. The distinction is that it's not being, there's not external stimuli that are causing pleasure. It's something that's flowing from the inside, kind of arising, not from the outside, from the inside out. When everything's in harmony, everything's kind of connected and settled. And when this becomes strong, you know, or this quality of your inner being is well established, then it's possible to go through the world and have unpleasant things happen, and they just kind of, it's like Teflon, it's like, or they don't really affect us. They're only, you know, they say skin deep. You know, okay, that was unpleasant, but, you know, there's that sense of stability and calm is still there. And there's something better, there's a better game in town than some of the kind of sense world and experiences around us. But interestingly, this is also true with our thoughts. That are, in a certain kind of way, if you allow me to kind of, this kind of language, a little generous to me is that you listen, is our thoughts are also a little bit external to this inner system of that it belongs to our qualities of well-being. Because you can have a thought that's unpleasant, and if you have enough inner well-being and stability, that thought doesn't impact anything. It doesn't go anywhere. It's just a thought. Or it could be that we have an unpleasant thought and suddenly our whole mood changes. We kind of just, everything shifts and change. We feel oppressed by it. Feel, oh no. That's, you know, and we're weighed down by the kind of thoughts we have. So do we allow our thoughts to impact us, or do we allow our thoughts to kind of just rain off like rain? This inner well-being is kind of like an umbrella, maybe more than a Teflon. So we have these thoughts that have all kinds of, you know, in some places they have acid rain, and so, you know, it's kind of painful to have the thoughts come in, but if you have an umbrella, then the rain just washes right off. So to have it's so easy to have thoughts for most of us, probably for some of you as well, that today you had more easy thoughts than you probably wish you had. And the thoughts come and go quite easily, and you know, are you in charge of your thoughts? Are thoughts you? Or is there some kind of impersonal quality of your thoughts, that thoughts just occur and, you know, that you just, you know, what's the connection between you, who you truly are, and your thoughts? It's an interesting question. My wife many years ago had a brief period of medically induced menopause. And it lasted, I don't know how long it lasted, maybe 3 months, and then she was back on course the way she was supposed to be. But during that time, she said to tell me, I'm having thoughts which are not my thoughts. You know, it's the hormones or something that's changing. These are not my thoughts. And she didn't recognize them as hers, and so she just let... She never told me what they were. maybe I never asked. But, you know, but why do we have thoughts, you know? Where these thoughts come through? And for some of us, thoughts are a dime a dozen. And, you know, all kinds of... Mind's capable of all kinds of bizarre things. In fact, one of the great lessons that I received growing up from my father was when I was about 14, he kind of had a little bit of a light father-son talk, and he said to me something like, as you grow up and live your life, from time to time you might have some bizarre thoughts. And then he said, don't worry about it, everyone has that. And so I lived my life, and sure enough, it happened, you know, once or twice, I think, that I had a bizarre thought. And I was prepared, I was ready, rather than being alarmed or like thinking this is great or whatever. So there's a sense of there's an impersonality in the thoughts. They're not necessarily, I don't have to define myself by my thoughts. But one of the ways that the reign of thoughts can affect our inner sensibility, how we are, is if we take the thoughts as personal, if we take them as real, or in terms of we give them a lot of authority. And there's a way in which that those the sense data of thoughts coming in, they land. And we get, you know, and they kind of reverberate inside, and they can leave traces inside of us in terms of our mood, our feelings. And we can have a whole series of feelings, inner feelings, where our quality of our inner life actually decreases dramatically because of the quality of the thoughts that we have. And because we're allowing them to come in, they come in a certain way. One of the things we learned from mindfulness practice is to recognize a thought as a thought, but it doesn't have to be anything else. And it's possible, some people find it very helpful when they label, use a mental note to say, oh, thinking, to add one word to that, or two words. It's only a thought. It's only a thought. And sometimes are only thinking. And sometimes that little addition somehow can break sometimes the trance or the authority or the caughtness in the thought. It's just a thought. And sometimes things are just a thought. It doesn't mean that the thought should be dismissed or ignored. It's a valuable thought. But not every thought that you have, please, right? I kind of doubt that your track record, if you've kept a statistical count of which thoughts you had were really significant and important and of great lasting value that you remember for years and years and really served your life, you know. I bet that it's a very, very small percentage of your thoughts. The track record of how successful your thoughts are and how useful they are, I guess, you know, is probably not that high. So it's possible with mindfulness practice, no, thinking. And after a while, get a sense of a thought arises and it goes, arises and it goes. And there's no latching onto it, no letting yourself getting involved in it. And mindfulness, when it's strong, it can function that way. It's quite freeing and nice. I myself have a very, I have a friendly relationship to my thinking. I kind of like my thinking. I enjoy thinking. My thinking has been kind to me, mostly. And, I feel like I think, you know, I'm not troubled too often by my thoughts. So, and I've learned how to be with my thinking so that it doesn't really interfere too much with my meditation. Sometimes it does. And I have to kind of do a course correction or do something. But, I have this kind of nice, positive relationship with my thoughts. Because I don't let them bother me. They're there. They can do their business. Sometimes they're like little flies, you know, friendly flies, you know, kind of buzzing around on the edges. And I just let them stay there. I don't, my thoughts recede to the periphery And I don't pay much attention to them sometimes. They don't, you know, I've learned not to be bothered by them or caught by them, and they just go through and they do what they do. And a lot of that is attributed to mindfulness practice, learn to see it clearly. But as we get settled and concentrated in the practice, then there's also this umbrella factor that builds up, the sense of inner well-being that develops. And that also becomes a little bit of a support. So it's not so automatic that the experiences of the world, the experiences of our mind, impact us in a deep way for our inner quality of being. And the more stable and stronger that inner sense of inner freedom is, or the inner sense of calm, or the inner sense of peace is, the more we have a reservoir, or we have a stability, or a place, or something that, you know, the things of the world kind of bounce off of, or we have a home where we can live, in a sense, and that home doesn't depend on what's happening in the world around us. And this is one of the great gifts of doing this practice, to have our inner sense of well-being independent of what's happening in the world around us. If we're dependent on what's happening in the world around us for our inner sense of well-being, you know, then we want to rearrange the world. If that's where we think our happiness is going to be, we're going to want to fix the world, get everything lined up just perfectly and get everyone to behave properly so that we get the pleasure, get the support, get all the things just perfect. And the, you know, problem with that is that it doesn't stop. People don't behave well enough. The world, the reality doesn't behave the way we want it to behave. So we're constantly having to fend it off or adjust it or keep doing the work. It's a lot easier to have an inner sense of peace, which is independent of the world out there. And then you don't have to always be fixing the world, fixing, you know, everything up and, you know, all the time. So the idea of having your happiness become independent, it doesn't mean that you can't be happy with what's going on in the world around you. It doesn't mean that you can't be impacted by what goes on around. It means that some core aspect of who you are is independent of all that. Some core inside, some stability or place of refuge or home, you know, is free and independent of the conditions of your life and how it is. What a gift to discover how to do that. That's phenomenal. So this distinction the Buddha makes between feelings of the flesh and feelings not of the flesh is a transition point in the practice of mindfulness practice. Because in his instructions on mindfulness, he starts with meditating on the breathing, and then he goes to being mindful of the body in various ways. And then he goes and talks about mindfulness of the feelings of the flesh. And then he talks about those feelings which are not of the flesh. And he clearly makes this distinction. And if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, this discourse where the Buddha gives his instructions, it's one of the most carefully constructed suttas of the Buddha. It's very carefully, it's almost, I don't know if it's geometrically or you know, kind of like math almost. It's very engineered, kind of structured carefully. And there's a number of suttas that are very carefully engineered in such a way that they have a midpoint. And the midpoint of the text is kind of like the climax. And this Satipatthana Sutta is one of them. I don't know if it's a climax, but it's a very important midpoint. And the way you see it is you see it numerically. There are 13 exercises in this discourse. And if you take the midpoint of 13, it's 7. Right? Is that right? My math is not so good. So there are 6 exercises on one side and 6 on the other. And the bridge between them is this exercise on the feelings of the flesh and not of the flesh. And so what happens is in this text, the first six exercises are about the body, and then it goes into the seventh exercise where there's a transition from of the flesh to of not of the flesh. And then the rest of the exercises have to do more with this inner life, the mind, what goes on there. So when there's enough stability and concentration, you focus on breathing, focus on the body, and stable enough, at some point, people become more and more aware of what they're sensing, what their experience is like on the inside, the quality of their being. And then we become the custodian of that. No one else can be the custodian of the quality of your inner life. That's really our own thing. And then to care for that and start understanding some of the conditions, cause and effect relationships of what goes on in there, what affects it, what influences it, what's the state of the mind or the heart in different situations. The quality, is this in the mind, the heart, the inner quality, does it feel collected, does it feel scattered, does it feel expansive, does it feel contracted, does it feel like it's kind of filled with greed and hate, or is it filled with love and generosity? What does it feel like in there, in the inner life? So we start becoming aware of that. And the external experiences we have, the pleasant and unpleasant experiences, what's happening in the world around us, starts becoming less important than the quality of our inner life, the quality of our being. And this opens up the door to appreciating more and more what helps us to be free and what keeps us from being free. To see the effect, the consequences of attachment and clinging. And you know, many people know that clinging is not good, to being attached is not good, but there's a whole different way of understanding our inner life when we actually feel and see the consequences of attachment, the consequences of clinging. And when there's a real letting go and freeing of clinging, the dramatic difference that happens to the inner quality of being as we have that release. And the sense of deep inner sense of well-being, of peace, of freedom, a kind of luminous emptiness that some people refer to. And then the clearer this experience becomes of this inner sense of well-being, the more it becomes a support for our lives and the more free we become. And it's very nice. So as you practice, it might be interesting, this distinction, to look at it and to see in your life what is it that affects the inner quality of your being? Are you letting the inner quality of your being be affected by the sense experiences of your life? The things that are going on in the external world, how far are you letting that kind of those rivers flow in? Or are you letting your thoughts that you have affect you? Granted, you can have all kinds of thoughts. Maybe you don't stop the rain, but do you let the rain to penetrate you? Do you really pick it up? Do you get involved? Or just let it wash right off? What's your relationship to all this stuff? And is there some place of a little bit greater freedom you can have in relationship to feelings of the flesh? There's nothing wrong with pleasant feelings in and of themselves. You don't have to kind of be now deny them, but pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings of the flesh, what's it like to be free of those? And to experiment in different situations. For me, in my early years of practice, I got lots of experience with pain. I didn't actually look for painful situations, but I remember there were occasions where I would had to do physical work that was very painful. I remember once I was living at the Zen Center, and I had to carry something really heavy with someone, another person, across the whole farm, Green Gulch Farm. It was a long distance. We had to carry it. And I remember the pain, the digging into my hands. And I got really curious. You know, like, what's going on here? What's the impact? What is it like to feel the pain but not be caught in it? What is it? What is it like? What is it like? And I didn't learn much except endurance from that exercise. But I can still remember, you know, I was trying to figure this out. What is this? What is this? And so, you know, not to turn away quickly from pain is an interesting thing to do. If you get a headache, that's a fascinating subject of mindfulness, because that's of the flesh, kind of, in this kind of language. And can, you know, explore and kind of, how do I find how to be with a headache so that I don't know what the, I'm not in pain. My head is in pain, but I'm not in pain. Or the inner quality of well-being is not in pain. How do we relate to it so we don't, it doesn't, you know, rein in and seep in and affect us? What is that like? And I've had fascinating times exploring headaches and all kinds of things. Sometimes I think I've been better at, sometimes it's easier with pain than it is with pleasure, just because it's more motivating to be free of pain than pleasure. So I hope this was interesting. I hope it was evocative and interesting for you to kind of look at your life and explore something. And I want to thank you all for coming. Some of you came maybe for part of the day. Some of you came for the whole day. And I'm very fond of saying at the end of these silent day-longs that it's one of my favorite things we do here at IMC. And partly it's my favorite because it's so invaluable to be able to spend a day in silence and just be with yourself, practice with yourself, see what comes up and keep working at it. And it's one of the, I have a lot of confidence that this is where there's a lot of deepening in the practice. And it's just, I hope it's nice to sometimes get teachings. But I think that, you know, teachings can only go skin deep or something. They can't go that far. And it's by doing this practice that the Dharma, the practice can really go deep in us. And so to have this opportunity and have so many people come and participate is a wonderful thing. And I thank you very much for it.